as Brother Rushmore has so eloquently presented, that the Bible is God's Word. And that because the Bible is of origin from a perfect God, an all-knowing, all-powerful God, then indeed, when it addresses subjects of geology and history and things like that that we can discover from the field of archaeology, as well as whenever we see the Bible referring to the Bible writers inspired by God addressing things that deal with the natural world, deal with the world of science, then indeed it's going to be accurate. What God has said is going to be scientifically proven. No more than what we can realize that, you know, sometimes these lessons come very firsthand. The psalmist, I believe it is, and in the last 36 hours, things have been kind of hectic for me, but talked to the psalmist, I believe it was, or Job, talked about the treasures in the snow. And certainly we know that that is a scientific fact that could not have been known at the time of the writer of that particular part of the Old Testament, because indeed, there is absolutely no way they could have seen the structure of a snowflake. How they, each one of them, they say that no two snowflakes are identical in their crystalline structure. As that water freezes, it falls through the atmosphere, going through part of what we call the hydrologic cycle, which several of the Bible writers refer to it, God's foreknowledge and inspiration. But as those crystals of snow come through the atmosphere and then land on the ground, of course, we know that there are great treasures in each individual snowflake when we look at them, photograph them, and of course that's a very difficult task because we know they don't last very long, returning into the liquid state that God has predestined all of these things to go through. But of course, there is also the downside of the treasures in the snow, and that refers to 12 inches of snow. And certainly, the last several days in Barber County, anyway, have been very trying and certainly been very interesting as we have seen a tremendously beautiful landscape, but one that has suffered a great deal of tree limbs and trees down and no power and all of the loss of the common things of life that you don't really miss until they're not with you any longer. And so, so I'm glad to be here and certainly thankful for the invitation from the School of Preaching and from the eldership and their oversight of this particular work to be able to be here. Certainly at the congregation in Bealington has had a great opportunity since the inception of the School of Preaching to have firsthand experience with those men who are graduating, and we've had two very good men and have appreciated the training and the background that they received under the oversight of the various individuals and the eldership of this congregation. We've also had opportunity in the last year or so to have three of this group of individuals, of men here now, come and speak for us and bring their families, and we've enjoyed them thoroughly, and certainly is encouraging to elderships, as myself, being in that position, realize the importance of men who are going to stand for God and what God has said, and to support with all of their efforts as best they can the preaching of God's Word into the future. And so that's always a tremendously encouraging sign. There are so many things in the Lord's Church today that are discouraging. It's good to see these opportunities be made available for the training in this area. So certainly we hope that the Lord will continue to bless the efforts here, Brother Cooper and all the teachers involved, as they continue to guide these young men into this most important work. We know that the Bible has many ways that it can be supported, many evidences that are able to show that the Bible is indeed God's Word. Those evidences can be external. They can be things outside of, as much of the archaeology is. That's external evidence that when a truth is revealed, then something from the discoveries of the world can be used to prove that the Bible is what it says. There's internal evidences that can be used, and several speakers at this lectureship have spoken on these topics, and certainly I know they have done a very good job. But we know that the Bible has to be God's Word, because when we look at what it says, what it reveals in its inspired pages, that given the knowledge of fallible men of their day, the brightest and most intelligent men of their time who studied the world around them, studied science and the things in the world around us, they had bad understanding. They had bad sciences, as it were. They had misunderstandings, just as the scientific community today. If you honestly believe that the scientific world that is out there today in the academic world and the research world has all the scientific answers, well, you're badly mistaken, because just like the scientists from ages past, scientists have rejected good science in favor of something that was popular. And we can look at many different things. From the area of washing your hands before surgery, I've had the opportunity to go into many operating rooms and to see surgeries of various types. We understand what they do in order to walk into that surgery. The doctors who are going to operate on them, on the patient, or if it were me, I would want to make sure that they don't have any of these microbes on their hands, the germs, the microscopic organisms that can be transmitted into the human body. And of course, we know that when Joseph Lister came up with that idea of, well, we need to wash our instruments, we need to wash our hands, we need to spray boric acid onto our instruments, even though it was a very unpleasant working environment, the popular scientists of the day said, that is insane. Why would anyone bother doing that? Your eyes water all the time. It's just no fun to do that. And yet, of course, we know today that the good science is that the bacterial world is out there, and it's waiting to get on us and do its very best to kill us. So the uninspired men in the days of the writers of the Old Testament and the New Testament certainly did not agree with what God revealed to those men. The scientific world did not support the findings of what was there. And of course, it was many thousands of years later before it became possible for us to be able to look and see that, okay, when the Bible talks about the paths of the sea, we can go out into the ocean and we can track the various ocean currents. I have my students in the 10th grade do this every year. They plot onto a world map literally hundreds of ocean currents that are at the surface. And then there are currents that run below the surface. And certainly it's a very complex situation that we find out there. And yet the psalmist in Psalms chapter 8 revealed that the paths were in the sea, and several other writers as well. But there's one thing I hope everybody realizes today. The Bible is not a science book. The Bible was not given to man to relate to him an understanding of the world around us. That's not why God inspired the Bible. That's not why God left it here. It was left here, as others today have said, to prove that God is and that Jesus is his Son, and through him we can have that hope of eternal salvation. And by doing what he wants us to do, what he commands us to do, we can have that home in heaven with him. That's what the Bible is for. And yet, the scientific accuracies should not be overlooked, because they can give us a great deal of meaningful support and build up our faith in ways that will really stand in the days of trial, and there are many in the world around us. I want us to start today with the very first book in the Bible, in the book of Genesis. And I'm not sure that I'll get out of the first book or the first chapter of the book of Genesis, because there is so much science revealed in that very first chapter of the book of Genesis that I don't really pay that much attention to it sometimes. Oh, we read the accounts and of the creation of the world and all these things. And yet, I think that there's much, much more information there than what we ever stop and take a look at. So if you will, I'd like for us to turn to Genesis chapter 1 and follow along with me as we look at just a few things. As we've had on display already this afternoon, Genesis 1, chapter 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. In that one verse by itself lays basically five of the fundamental things that the world of science deals with. The scientific community deals with various aspects of the world around us. And in verse 1, we see time in the beginning. Time was brought into existence, of course, with the creation of the world. We know that time does not exist outside of this world. When our lives on this earth end, then time has ceased to be. Time is only at God's creation. Time is only here because God set it into motion. So in the beginning, and of course time is a foundational point upon which much science is built. In the beginning, God is the force that is involved. You realize that the scientific world has no explanation for the forces that brought this universe into existence if God is taken out of the picture. And literally, they scratch their heads for what caused the Big Bang, what is the origin, why did everything become something out of nothing? And that's what they have to conclude, that nothing blew up and became everything. Well, obviously, they've got a problem because we're here. It's here. The universe is here. They can't deny it. And yet, when you go back to the very fundamental question, how did it get here? What force produced it? They are absolutely clueless. They have gotten to the point now where mathematically there are some that are saying, well, maybe it is possible for something to come from nothing. Well, I wish they would make something come out of nothing for me. You know, I could think of several things that would be useful if they could make it come out of nothing. Of course, they can. And so we see that God is the force behind everything that's going to happen from this point on. So time and force are present in verse 1. Then God created. That is the energy God put into this universe. God, as it were, wound up the cosmic clock, if you want. God set everything in motion, and from that point on, we see that the world has responded under what we call the second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy, which basically says if you take a wind-up, one of these spring wind-up clocks, and you wind it up and you set the time on it, and the time's accurate, and you set it down and you let it run, that mainspring in there is going to slowly, as time passes, expend the energy that you put into it to turn the little key to make it wind up. It's going to expend that energy, and the energy that's stored in that system is going to run down. And so we see that that's exactly what is happening in the universe around us. As opposed to the evolutionary and the atheistic viewpoint of how the world got here, they believe that nothing exploded, became everything, and is getting more and more complex as time goes on. The evolutionists are working in direct opposition to the very basic laws of science themselves. And so we see that the energy that was necessary for the existence of everything was revealed to us in verse 1. It was created. It was brought into existence. Well, as those mathematicians might be observing, out of nothing. But of course, we know that that is not something that we're ever going to understand. Feeble scientific minds today will never understand the power of God. In this life, I'm not sure we're capable of understanding the power of God. Certainly His ways are so much greater and His thoughts so much greater than our thoughts. And so we can see that energy was there in the very beginning. Then created heaven, space. Space is certainly an issue that's foundational in the field of science. And matter, the earth. And so in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Is the very beginning, the very foundation upon which modern science, and actually science since science has been studied, has been laid upon. Those basic principles are foundational to the things that science studies. So indeed, we can see in verse 1 the tremendous scientific accuracy of God's inspired word. And of course, we know that from verse 1 to the last verse in the book of Revelation, there is not going to be any inaccuracies in the Bible, period. That doesn't mean feeble human minds are ever going to understand it or ever going to be able to know exactly what God intended, but we can have full assurance that indeed there is not any inaccuracies, whether they be archaeological, historical, scientific, and if we never come to an understanding of the things that God tells us, that doesn't mean they aren't accurate. That simply means we can't understand them. And so certainly we can have full assurance and full confidence in the scientific accuracy of the Bible. Well, let's look at some other things in the first chapter of the book of Genesis. As we move on down through with the creation of the world, we can see that down about verse 11, jumping down to some things maybe that make a little more sense. Some things don't always make sense that I try to present, so we'll go to something maybe that's a little bit easier to understand. And God said in verse 11 of Genesis 1, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after its kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth." And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass and herb yielding seed after his kind. And the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind. And God saw that it was good. You can go over to verse 21, and you see the same type of words after the creation of the animals there. After his kind. After his kind, in verse 22 and 23 and 24 and 25, we see repeatedly over and over again that God commanded the living things that he created to be fruitful and multiply after his kind. Now, one of the things that's absolutely crucial to the concepts of evolutionary science is the idea that things change. Things have to change in order for a single-celled animal to become a multiple-celled organism, to become a protozoan, to become a invertebrate, to become a vertebrate, to become a salamander, a fish, and right on, a reptile, and right on up the line, there has to be some method by which they can explain all of the life forms that they would say from one single-celled organism. And so they depend upon things being born that aren't like their parents. And yet God very clearly commanded each of these organisms, the plants in verses 11 and 12, the animals in 21 through 26, God very clearly commanded those animals to be fruitful and to multiply after its kind. Well, one of the popular ideas of scientists back in the 1800s was that called spontaneous generation. That when conditions became just right, that the molecular material, the carbohydrates and the proteins and the lipids and all these other macromolecules necessary for a living thing, even the simplest of living things, even a single bacterium, is complex beyond our wildest imaginations whenever you stop and see how much DNA is in there, how much protein is in there, how much lipids and fats are in there, how many carbohydrates it takes to make that single one bacterial cell. It certainly is important for us to understand that that's extremely, extremely complex. And for it to be able to make a copy of itself after its kind, in order to do that, it's got to have a very specific set of instructions. We call those instructions DNA. And I'm sure several speakers have spoke about the complexities of DNA and the fact that that indeed shows that there had to be a designer, a creator, a God who knew how for each living thing they would need this set of instructions in order to be able to copy themselves after its kind. Making a copy of itself faithfully every time, time after time after time after time after time. And of course, you may have seen the mathematical problems. If you have a bacteria that reproduces, undergoes fission or reproduction once every 20 minutes, how many you would have at the end of 24 hours? Well, we kind of have an idea, because if we get one of those bacteria in our throats and we get one in there and all of a sudden it starts dividing and one becomes 2 and 2, 4 and 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, and so on, we know that the end of a few hours or maybe 12 hours, man, our throat's starting to get sore. And, you know, after a couple of days, we've got these big colonies of bacteria living in our throat, Streptococcus or some of the bacterial strains that can make their homes inside of our bodies. And so we can see that very faithfully we see living things reproduce after their kind. This is a scientific fact that I believe for many years I overlooked. And I really didn't think about the importance of this. But this is absolutely fundamental to the field of biology, to the field of genetics, and to so much that we see in the world around us. Spontaneous generation, that things could just come about when conditions were right, was absolutely disproven by a scientist by the name of Louis Pasteur in the 1800s. And what became known now as the facts of science, quote-unquote the facts of science, is the law of biogenesis. Bio meaning life, genesis meaning beginning. The law of biogenesis, that all living things come from other living things. Right? Not just spontaneously appearing when conditions become right. I mean, when we look at life, there's really not a lot of complexity to it. God created us and all living things from the dust of the ground. And so we would expect to find carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, the same types of material that are in the atmosphere and the earth, and phosphorus and iron and magnesium and boron and zinc and well, that's the same stuff that's in a bacteria. That's the same stuff that's in a plant. That's the same stuff that's in all life forms around us, because indeed God used the materials that He formed as He created the world to create life from. And so we should expect that indeed we would have a very similar makeup to those living things around us. And so the law of biogenesis, life coming from other life, certainly flew in the face of the scientific world in the days of the writing of Moses, when Moses wrote the book of Genesis, certainly had no concept of this idea of living things are going to faithfully and accurately reproduce themselves every time and every time and every time. And yet, when we see the world around us today, we see mommy and daddy dogs and their puppies are born, Well, they're identical copies of mommy and daddy dogs or cats or whatever it is, whether it's fruit trees, you know, the maple trees that are dropping so many acorns back in our part of the state right now. If we planted each one of those acorns and allowed it to germinate, allowed it to grow and reproduce after its kind, it's going to be an oak tree. It's not going to be some other type of organism, as the evolutionary scientists absolutely have to have, because they have to have times when there are going to be freaks, times when there are going to be what they call mutations. And do mutations occur? Absolutely. There is not a person in this room or the person anywhere in the world that does not realize that from time to time, in this complex process of reproduction, of reproducing after its kind, that there are going to be mistakes made. Fortunately, these are the rare exception. Fortunately, these are not the norm. Fortunately, and 99% of the time, these mutations, as it were, are actually lethal, if not harmful, to those organisms that have them. And so the law of biogenesis is just a repeating of Genesis 1, chapter 11, or verse 11 and verse 12 and so on. God commanded all living things to be fruitful and multiply after their kind. Well, that still doesn't fit the likings of the popular scientific world. And so they have come up with, they know that they can't use mutations to explain all of these things. They can't use mutations because mutations, and they readily admit, are not helpful, are not beneficial to most organisms. And so they have had to come up with another idea, because they can't go back to spontaneous generation. Well, they do. They have to go back to things appearing once, because they don't have any other answer for how that first protozoan life form would have come into existence. So they have to go back and they say, oh, under different circumstances, this is possible. Well, that just flies in the face of everything they want to tell us in the field of genetics, and they have to break their own rules that they say are so sound and so unmovable. But they'll break them when it's at their, for their convenience and keeps them in business, as it were. And so we find that there's another idea that's out there. It's called punctuated equilibrium, which is used to explain, when we examine the fossil record, and certainly the fossil record is a powerful ally towards the Christian. It should be used. We should understand it better. Not that we can explain everything, but we should understand that when we look at the fossil record, it gives us evidence that God indeed created things the way he did and destroyed things the way he did, as recorded in the Bible. And certainly that's another scientific accuracy, that of the flood of Noah. And we'll not have time to get into that today, but that's another tremendous piece of scientific evidence that we can look in the world around us and see. Most of West Virginia is covered with sandstone. Much of West Virginia has fossils that are sea creatures, brachiopods and crinoids, which are all saltwater living things. And yet, here they are at the top of the mountains, you know, 2,000, 3,000 feet high in the mountains of West Virginia. All right, certainly a great testament to the fact that God did flood the world by water, as he said in Genesis chapter 6 through 9. But certainly the ideas of spontaneous generation, that two living things can undergo the process of reproduction and produce, maybe, let's say, mommy and daddy lizard. Let's just take an example. Mommy and daddy lizard are going to reproduce and have babies. They're going to have a clutch of eggs. And mommy lays five eggs. And four of those eggs hatch, and they're perfect little copies of mommy and daddy lizard. I mean, they're just so cute, spitting images of mommy and daddy lizard. But that fifth egg delays two or three days in its hatching. It lays there in the sun a little bit longer, and then they finally start to see the egg start to crack, and they hear some weird sounds coming out of this egg. And all of a sudden, a little head pokes through, and, ooh, what is this thing? This doesn't look right. And a couple minutes later, the rest of it comes out, and it's got two legs and two front limbs that don't appear to be functional at all for running around like mommy and daddy lizard. And after the skin starts to dry, as the amniotic fluid and the other fluids dry off of it, it's a baby bird. That is exactly what the evolutionary world wants us to swallow today as punctuated equilibrium. That is how we see the fossil record. And that's what they say, that the fossil record goes along with lizards, 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 bird. All right? And yet, the lizard evolved into the bird, according to them. Well, how do they explain that? They put a big name on it, punctuated equilibrium. It really doesn't mean anything, all right, scientifically, because we can't show that happening. They cannot demonstrate that happening because all living things reproduce after their kind. God commanded. God put into the DNA of each living thing the instructions that it would need to copy itself, to make its DNA into two copies, and then a special process that would take half of that copy in a process called meiosis, which actually splits the chromosomes in two, so that dad, male, the male of the species, donates half of the chromosomes and mom donates half the chromosomes, so that when the babies are born, in the case of humans, we have 46 chromosomes, just like our parents, just like mom and dad and grandma and grandpa and great-grandma and grandpa, and you get the idea. As far back as we can go, mom and dad, all of these individuals had 46 chromosomes. That's exactly what God commanded. God told us this was what they would do, and this is what happens today. And so we can see that after his kind is a tremendous proof of the scientific foreknowledge of God. And yet we don't seem to pay much notice to it, and I'm guilty of that as probably everyone else. This idea of after his kind also explains macro and microevolution. These are terms that are out there in the world. Microevolution, very small changes, and it's absolutely scientifically proven, and certainly not against what God's Word says, that things will change. Bacteria evolves, quote unquote, to become resistant to penicillin. That's not anything other than those bacteria, whether it's Escherichia coli, which is one of the most common bacteria in the world, whether that bacteria changes and becomes resistant over time to the chemicals that we use to try to kill it. That doesn't mean that that bacteria is not a bacteria. That simply means it has developed within its genetic makeup some resistance to the drugs, the environmental conditions that it finds itself. And so that is microevolution. And the peppered moth that the evolutionists use, Darwin's finches that the evolutionists use, these are all examples of microevolution and are nothing but these living things reproducing after their kind. That's all it is. And it should not in any way threaten someone who believes in the literal account of the creation of the world, that God said it, brought it, spoke it into existence, and here it is. And so, but the evolutionists in the textbooks that I teach out of that are at the college level and at the high school level, they want to take this microevolution, and they build the case for microevolution and these changes within species, these changes within the DNA makeup that God gave the bacteria, that God gave the birds, that God gave the moths and things like that. And they want to say, okay, this is scientifically proven. Now, we're going to say, if that's possible, then it's possible for those species to jump and become, well, there we go back to mommy and daddy lizard having a baby bird. Okay? And, of course, there is no evidence scientifically that that's even possible. And, indeed, macroevolution, as it's called, flies in the face of Genesis chapter 1. Because that would be living things not reproducing after their kind. So punctuated equilibrium, spontaneous generation, all of these things certainly have no relevance to the world that we see around us. Well, we can also see in Genesis chapter 1 several things that God has provided man. In verse 28 of Genesis chapter 1, it says, "And God blessed them, and God said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that creepeth upon the earth." I don't care how far you go back in historical records, as far back as archaeology can take us, as far back as man's understanding of humans have always shown a dominance over the animals of the world. There is not any scientist today that would ever say man has not had dominance and preeminence over the animals. I mean, even if they want to believe in Homo erectus and Australopithecus afarensis and all these things, they still recognize that there is a uniqueness among those living things that indeed is a dominance over the animals, the elements and things around us as much as we can control. And so man has always obeyed God's command to have dominion over these living things. And certainly that is still true today. And of course, God also said that when man was created, he was created in the image of God. Well, you know, that certainly is very scientific from one standpoint, but it's not so scientific from another. Because we know that God is not carbohydrates and proteins and lipids and nucleic acids, DNA and RNA. We know that that's not the makeup of God. God does not have a physical being. God, of course, is spiritual. And it's our spiritual nature of man that, number one, sets us apart from the animals, because we do not see any animals, well, constructing facilities like this, having opportunities to come together to inform one another of things like this, to make music, to sing, to praise, to worship something. We don't see this in the animal world. And yet, do you realize that when it comes down to the nuts and bolts of it, RNA, DNA, carbohydrates, proteins, and lipids, that you and me and a chimpanzee are just virtually identical. 98% alike in our DNA structure. Now, that's awful close. Well, for the evolutionists, that's way too close. Because if indeed humans and chimpanzees are just 98% alike in our DNA structure, then why don't we see artistic monkeys? Why don't we see musically talented monkeys? They won't even build themselves a shelter out of the rain. And yet they have the manual dexterity. They have fingers and hands. They can create great beds, I understand. Watching some of the observations of Jane Goodall and the African chimpanzees, they can make some great sleeping places. They fold branches down, they pull leaves off, and they put cushions in there and padding, and they get themselves a nice, comfortable sleeping nest. And yet when it comes to downpour, and they absolutely hate the rain, they do not take their same two dexterous hands and build themselves a little shelter. They won't even go under a rock and get out of the rain. Now, something is different, and so we see that the DNA difference between humans and, of course, the monkeys, while it's very, very close, is much too close for the evolutionists. They would prefer that the chimpanzees were maybe 85% alike us, and other animals weren't. You know, we're not that far off from the little mice that run around. DNA-wise, it's like 89% of human and mouse DNA is identical. There's just a very small variation, and yet that speaks to the eloquence, of course, of the design that God put into the DNA. And so the scientific accuracy in chapter 1 of the book of Genesis, and of course we could continue. God said, and forget who it was earlier today, talked about the, and it was very good in Genesis chapter 1, verse 31. When God created the world, the world was perfect. God doesn't make bad things. It was perfect at that time. And of course, sin came into the world, and we see the hurricanes and the storms and the earthquakes that are here today. But that was because of man's sin, not certainly what God had created. God's creation was perfect. It was very good. And so we can see then that when we uncover fossils and evidence of a tropical paradise in Antarctica and in the Siberia, that the entire world at one point was just an absolutely perfect place in which to live. And that's indeed exactly what we see. As God has described in verse 31, it was very good. Well, we can move on to many of the normal things that in the field of geology, we certainly know that, you know, the circle of the earth in Isaiah 40, verse 22. We can talk about the earth hanging upon nothing. Of course, flying in the face of the scientists of the day from the field of geology. Certainly many things there. The hot springs in the ocean, Job chapter 38, verse 16. God asked Job, "Hast thou entered into the springs of the sea, or hast thou walked in search of the depth?" Of course, at that time, the writing of Job, you know, we had no clue. And even in the time of Benjamin Franklin, we had no clue what was at the bottom of the ocean. And yet here God reveals the existence of these hot springs, these locations on the bottom of the ocean, of course, which have been discovered today. The weather cycles in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 6 and 7, it's very clear that God is describing the water vapor going up into the air and coming down in its season as rain and snow, and it continually whirleth about. And so we can see that, and it goes into the rivers, and then goes to the sea, and does it all over again. God is describing what is now called the hydrologic cycle. Thousands and thousands of years prior to modern science understanding these principles, God revealed them. And so we can see that time and time and time again, of course, time does not permit us to go into all of them. We could go into the area of astronomy with the stars, and how certainly God revealed to Abraham that his descendants would be like the sands of the sea and the stars of the heavens. And of course, that didn't certainly fit well with the astronomers of the day, and even 1700s, 4,000 years later, because they said, "Oh, we can still count them. You know, 1,024, 1,022. Yeah, we can count them." Until they get their little piece of glass out, and they go scratching on it and shaping it down. They look through it. "Oh, wait a minute, what's that? Oh, there's more than..." And then they get a bigger telescope. "Whoa, what's that?" And then we get a bigger one. And of course, every time we get a bigger telescope, we simply reveal the truth of God's explanation and under inspiration, His revealing of what He has done in the world around us. And so we can see that scientific accuracy of the Bible is absolute. Without a doubt, it's something that I believe that each one of us today, the more we hear of these things and the more I study in the field of science, the more I'm absolutely convinced that while God didn't use His Bible as a science book, it is still, when He refers to the natural world around us, going to be right. Now, if God's Word is right in the scientific, everything that we can understand scientifically, if God's Word is revealed when we finally catch up with what God understood so many thousands of years ago, if it's revealed that that is accurate and never been proven wrong once, not once in any area of archaeology, of historical reference, of scientific explanation or scientific mention, then why would we choose to believe that God's Word is going to be wrong about our soul's salvation? There is not one reason in the world why we cannot go to the New Testament and read the life of Jesus and read His teachings and read what He commanded and what He taught His disciples and apostles that they should teach and what they should do. And then as they revealed, as they began on the day of Pentecost, as Peter and the other apostles preached the story of Jesus and what had happened and how He had lived and who He was, and of course went on to explain when those people asked, what do we need to do to be saved? And of course, Peter told them. And certainly today we need to be doing that with the world around us. We need, number one, not to be afraid of, as Brother Rushmore has mentioned, the archaeological evidence, because it proves the Bible. We need not to be afraid of the scientific evidence, because when we understand what God has revealed, it proves the existence of God. It proves that God, the Bible, has to have a supernatural being as the one who created everything that's here and then revealed it to us, maybe in ways that we'll never understand, but certainly that doesn't mean that He didn't reveal it to us. The Bible is scientifically accurate and is tremendous evidence for the existence of God. This afternoon, today, you've heard tremendous lessons, foregoing this one, I believe, but you've heard some very good lessons about the presence, the existence of God, and that the truths that are revealed here are from Him. If you've never taken the opportunity to be obedient to that God of the Bible, who is in charge of all of these marvelous explanations that we and revelations that we can see, if you've never obeyed His God, His plan of salvation, then now's the opportunity. Now's the time when you can do that. The water is available. Everything is available for you to take advantage, to be obedient to the God of the universe. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He's also going to take it out of existence. Man doesn't understand how that can be, no more than we can understand how He brought it into existence, and yet we know it's going to happen. So this afternoon, if you need to obey the gospel plan of salvation, everything is ready. We'd encourage you to do that. If you've done that and allowed the cares of the world and the temptations that Satan puts out there in the field of evolutionary science, and that has drawn you away from the God of the creation, the God of the Bible, who inspired and provided all the information we have, elders here or the ministers would be happy to join with you in prayer with the congregation here, that God would forgive you of those things so that you could be made right in His sight and leave this place knowing that you'll have that hope of eternal salvation. Whatever your need might be this afternoon, we'd encourage you to come as we stand and sing the song selected.